Hello, everyone. This is your co-host, Stu, and I'm here with the paranormalist, Patty Wilson. Hi, Patty. How are you?
I'm fine. How are you doing this evening?
Pretty good. So we didn't get a chance to record this past weekend, which was Sunday was Mother's Day. Did you have a nice Mother's Day?
I had a lovely Mother's Day, and I got to see all my boys but one. His kids were sick, so we decided to, you know, wait and do that later.
Okay. I didn't do much. Yeah, we, you know, burgers and dogs on the grill, and then Mrs. Stu wanted to go for a ride. You know, evidently, every so often we'll do that. And we just took a nice long ride and burned a quarter of a tank of gas and had a good time.
So, well, that sounds like fun. I love that whenever you get to go for just a drive.
Mm-hmm. Well, we had to take her car, which gets better gas mileage than mine does. So, all right. Well, I think I told you this past week, too, we picked up a couple more subscribers, and we are very thankful for that. We are happy to have everyone join us. Hopefully you enjoy our content. If you do, please be so kind as to click the like button down below on whatever platform you're looking at. Rate us however you'd like. If you're on YouTube, please consider subscribing and clicking the bell so you get notified when we release new content, which is typically Fridays around 7 p.m. Sometimes I'm a little later, 7:20, but you know, it's normally around 7. We have the three Facebook groups, the Paranormalist Podcast, the Paranormalist Group Share, and the Paranormal Asylum, which I think you started the Paranormal Asylum long, long ago.
Yes, it's been a labor of love for many years.
That one's been there for a while. And we also have the email address, paranormalist@theparanormalistpodcast.com, to send us your ideas, your feedback, your comments, stories, whatever you'd like to send us in a private mode. That way that if you don't want to put anything public on the YouTube channel or the Facebook pages, that's perfectly okay too.
Yeah. Please let us know what you guys are interested in so that we can, you know, do a story line on all of that. We're having a lot of fun, and I get suggestions from time to time. In fact, this evening's is going to be a suggestion from somebody.
Oh, and what might that be?
Well, I met a young gentleman, a friend of mine, who listens to the podcast faithfully, and he asked me if it was possible to tell ghost stories from the Civil War that were not about Gettysburg. So for those who are from other places, we live a couple hours outside of Gettysburg, so most of the Civil War stories we hear in this region are Gettysburg-based, but this was the easiest request I do believe I have ever had.
Well, I mean, the Gettysburg battle was, what, 3 days?
Yeah, it was 3 days, 51,000 casualties. It was horrendous. When you look at the whole thing, it's insane. I'm only going to do a few stories because literally I could do 400 stories. And there's a wonderful book by my friend Mark Nesbitt, which is Battlefield Trails, and it is all the ghost stories. He actually went to the battlefields, collected the stories, spent an entire summer, and I recommend it highly. I did not deliberately use any of the stories from his book, but if you're really interested in the subject, I recommend that book to you. And with that, we're going to start. So I started at the beginning. The event that was one of the catalysts for the Civil War. And we have to recognize that the Civil War took decades to get there. It was not something that just erupted quickly and suddenly. In fact, probably had James Buchanan not been president, it could have changed everything. Buchanan was a lousy president. I say that with great humility because he's also Pennsylvania's only president ever. But he was a lousy president. He was more interested in parties and you know, socialization than he was in actually being the president of the United States. During his tenure, he cut the military spending significantly. He was focused on a lot of other stuff. He was this sounds crazy, but there are people who believe he was a Confederate sympathizer. And he believed that, like, the Dred Scott decision would just kind of smooth it all over and status quo would remain. So this is what caused all this enmity to build up, among other things. And that brings us to John Brown. So John Brown was one of the precipitating factors to the Civil War. And this is at Harper's Ferry in West Virginia. It's a fascinating place where you're walking shoes and make sure your legs are in good shape, because the entire town is literally uphill, downhill, uphill, downhill, uphill, downhill. It's a very strenuous walk. So basically what happened is that John Brown decided to force the Civil War to happen. So he decided he was going to go in to this area, steal guns from the armory at this area, and then arm the slaves, and then the slaves would revolt and have an uprising, which would then force the government to have the Civil War. And it actually did help, but it didn't help for the reasons he thought. So with that said, let's visit some of the stories from old John Brown as we go through all of this. Probably the one of the most tragic stories is about a guy named Dangerfield Newby. Now, Dangerfield Newby was he was a black man, and he was a free black man who had won his freedom by purchasing it. He wanted to buy his wife and children's freedom, and he had come to the realization he probably would never have enough money to do so. He had thought he had had enough. He had written to the slave owner, and the guy basically said, no, if you can come up with twice that amount, maybe. And you can imagine how devastating that would be. So he hooks up with John Brown, realizing that if there's a civil war, it might be possible for him to steal away his family and bring them north. And unfortunately, Dangerfield ends up being the first person killed in this conflict, this armed conflict, where they attacked the armory and tried to steal the weapons that were there. There was a very light amount of protection for the armory, to be honest with you. And the guys coming in with Brown didn't have a whole lot of weaponry on their own. So Dangerfield gets attacked by a resident with a 6-inch spike attached to his rifle. And they didn't know what was going on, the local people. They just knew that somebody was trying to raid the armory. It didn't look good, you know? So they were trying to protect the town. And he gets stabbed in the throat, and it kills him. He's left in an alley laying there, stabbed, bleeding out. As the battle, this whole thing ensues, it takes a couple days. So for that couple days, the town is on lockdown. People are in their basements. The men are trying to figure out, you know, patrol. This is an entire odyssey that happens, and it's something that was unprecedented. We had not seen that since the American Revolution. And during that period, poor Dangerfield is laying in that alley, and unfortunately, the pigs found him. And I don't want to say any more about that part, but you get it. And he has been seen in that alley, running through the alley, looking like he's frightened, you know, like he's fighting that phantom battle one last time. And that is one of the very first ghost stories I ever heard about it. He's always seen, a lot of people say he has a scar across his throat. He has baggy pants on and a big slouched hat. He acts like he's absolutely terrified. He's seen running down the street, turns into the alley, and if anybody follows him, there is nowhere for him to go, and he's just gone. So it is, as you can see, the first bloody moments. Now, then the slaves in that Brown wanted to arm, they weren't stupid. And so they decided that this was a lousy idea, because it looked like if they took guns, they would get shot. And that makes sense. You know, if you're taking guns and you're going to turn them on the military, they're going to shoot back. So they knew that was a bad idea.
Yep, you become a combatant. Yeah.
So they don't do it. It doesn't work out that way. Brown gets caught. He will stand trial for the treasonous acts and will be hung in a nearby city in West Virginia. But Harper's Ferry becomes a magnet during the battles, during the actual war. And there are several ghost stories that come from that. And believe it or not, there was actually a haunting prior to that. that is known from the Revolutionary War, but I'll stick with the Civil War. So Brown himself has been seen strolling the streets of Harper's Ferry. He was a very distinctive figure. If you look at pictures of him, he was, how do you explain him? Big, black, graying beard, long hair, dressed, you know, like a preacher. And he was a very distinctive figure. Once you've seen that, the paintings of him and what have you, you will never forget them. Very much a man that, of his time. And he has been seen walking along the streets, smiles at people. There's stories about tourists pointing, thinking he's a reenactor. Some have even actually taken their pictures with him, only to like to turn around to say thank you, and he's not there. When they look at the pictures when they're developed, they find that where there should have been somebody, they're looking up at nothing. There's nothing there. So, you know, that's a quite a experience to be had. Now, sitting on the bluff above Harper's Ferry is this beautiful old Catholic church called St. Peter's Catholic Church. During the battles in the Civil War, that church was pressed into service as a field hospital. They would lay planks across the pews and lay the injured and dying there. There was a priest there by the name of Father Michael Costello. He attempted to render aid. He made it known to everyone that whether you were a Northern or a Southern combatant, all men would be given aid and there would be no war in his church. And he was adamant about this. He was also a very grief-stricken from what he was seeing. This was heartrending for these people. Not just the fact that this is a battle, that not just that, you know, this is our nation falling to pieces. Nobody knew if at the end of it, it was going to be our nation or it was going to be torn to pieces. So he would go out at night and he would pray. Sitting in the cemetery, he would just get on his knees and he would pray. And people would later talk about, you know, the injured and those who were up there helping, about how, you know, no matter how exhausted he was, every night he would go out and stand in the cemetery and just weep and talk to God and say, please, you know, let this end, give us strength, that sort of thing. He has been seen in the cemetery by the church. People see him standing there, usually at dusk, and he's doing his devotions, and then he turns around and walks back past them wearing the older clerical clothing of that time, and he walks into the church, and people have attempted to follow him to talk to him, thinking, again, he's a reenactor,
right?
And there is no one there. There is another story of the church itself. It is about a young Catholic man who was brought to the makeshift hospital inside of the church, and he realized as he came in that he was not the most severely injured of all these people. He was, he had a better chance to survive than most. And so he was laid aside and asked to wait for help until they could deal with some of the more pressing wounds. And he said, I can wait. But unfortunately, the wounds were a lot worse than originally thought. And so he crawled inside of the doorways of the Catholic church there, and he passed away waiting to be carried inside the rest of the way. And when he got inside the doors of the church, as he looked up, saw the altar, and he felt like he was, at least he had made it this far. And those who were there said that his last words were, "Thank God I'm saved." And there are people who claim to see this white mass crawling through the doorway and hearing the words, "Thank God I'm saved," before the mass disappears.
Quite interesting.
It is, and I will tell you, it's a fascinating area, tons and tons of history from Revolutionary period to Civil War. Interestingly enough, Robert E. Lee's father, I believe it was, actually fought in a battle at Harper's Ferry. And people don't realize it, but there's a huge train of coincidences that go through these two wars, and that is one of them. So I moved on from Harper's Ferry to the actual beginning of the Civil War. And that, of course, took place at Fort Sumter. Now, Fort Sumter was named for a Revolutionary War officer, and it sits on the at the edge of the water. And at one point would actually be pressed into service as a lighthouse as well. Now, everything kind of starts falling apart as soon as Lincoln gets elected. Lincoln was the first Republican ever elected as a president. Everybody was a lot antsy about what he was going to do, because he was talking about, you know, slavery and other issues. But I want to make this perfectly clear. Slavery did not become a national issue for the Civil War until 1863. The precipitating factor was when South Carolina decided that they did not want to sit under a Republican president. They seceded from the Union, taking six other states with them, so a total of seven. At that point, Lincoln decides he can't fix this. So he sends some troops down to Fort Sumter, which was still being remodeled. It's been remodeled for 60 years. And a lot of that goes back to Buchanan. Buchanan was parsing off the money, so they never got to really fill it up with the amount of guns it needed, the amount of ammunition it needed. Walls weren't completed. It was sitting since the 1812. And it's not all, obviously, that many years. It's not all Buchanan, but Buchanan really put a hurting on it. And so he sends this gentleman, his name's Captain Anderson, and a small force. And they're supposed to take it over. And they do. It's American property. It's an American fort. They go in and take Fort Sumter. And then after Lincoln becomes president, he knows things are going to get bad. He figures South Carolina is going to try to take Fort Sumter, that their militias will try. So he sends Major Anderson, and then after that, he sends a gentleman by the name of Fox, his last name was Fox, to go down and help reinforce this fort. Again, they still don't have all the weapons they need. So this gentleman, Augustus Fox, comes. He leads a fleet in the Charleston Harbor, which is where this fort sits, and they know that there's got to be an attempt. This is a great place, you know, to protect the harbor. If you have this, you own that whole section. You own a place where you can bring goods and ships in to get stuff from other countries, because you have to know, if you're going to start the Civil War, or that the North, which was the supply line, wasn't going to supply the Confederates. So now you're looking at France and England and bringing ships over with goods and that they need, and they have to have places where they can safely dock. This would be it. So what ends up happening is Commander Fox and Anderson, they're waiting. And then on the 11th of April, 1861, a commander by the name of Beauregard demanded that Anderson and Fox surrender the fort, and they say no. These are American military officers holding down an American military fort, and they absolutely refuse. So on the 12th at 4:30 in the morning, the Confederates attack the fort, and they bombard it for 34 hours straight. 7,000 cannonades went off. I cannot imagine what that must have looked like. And interestingly enough, Anderson doesn't answer fire for hours. He just sits there taking the shelling. It's at least 2 to 4 hours before he decides to start firing back. Now, there are people who say that he might have done that because he was hopeful that if he didn't fire on the Confederates, that it would calm, or heads would prevail eventually, and if he didn't draw blood, then maybe the Confederates would stop and settle down. However, modern historians are looking back and saying there might have been a completely different reason. You see, Anderson grew up in the South. And so he had family there. And it might have been that he was loath to fire back on what would be to him kinsmen. And he waited until he really could have done nothing else, but it would have been dereliction of duty to not fire back. And then he finally began to fire back. However, they did not have the amount of weapons and munitions they needed to answer what was a huge onslaught. So eventually, obviously, they have to give up the fort. So at that point, there's one Confederate soldier who died because of one of their own cannons misfiring. On the Union side, there's two soldiers that died during the battle. And after Anderson and Fox finally say they will surrender, they say, may we give a 100-shot salute before we leave. Now they're going to be effectively prisoners of war, you know, and they don't know what that means at this point. So they begin this 100-shot salute. At about shot 47, there was a young man who was, his gun misfired and it blew up in his, and he died. At that point, everybody lost their taste for this and they realized that it was pointless. So they stopped at 50 and then they abandoned the fort. So it was a mess from that point forward. The young soldier whose face was blown up during the battle will be one of the spirits that people continuously see. Now, just for a little history, over the course of the war, so we're talking up till the 1865, the Union soldiers repeatedly attempt to take back Fort Sumter and are not able to. The Confederates hold it all the way through the war. There are numerous times when there are Union casualties. There was at least 8 men who were killed, 19 wounded, and 105 more captured during that period of time, and several more attempts after that. Now, there's just no way they could get, first of all, it's so highly defensive that it's a really difficult place to, you know, to get into. And so the Confederates had it, and they made sure it was really well reinforced. They finished the job that Buchanan didn't do because they needed to keep that port open. So the young man who had died in that 100-shot salute, his name was Daniel Hogue. And it wasn't long after the Union abandoned the fort that the Confederates began to talk about the Union soldier they saw wandering through the fort. They would describe this young man as a Union soldier. Some of them claimed there was more than one. Remember, there would have been 3 who had died that day. And they said that you would smell gunpowder and smoke, and then you would look and you would see the presence of the soldier or the soldiers, depending on who saw it. And that often he would be looking at the flag where the flags had flown, the American flag, and saluting it. And to be honest with you, that's exactly when he got shot. He had shot his weapon, and the guy next to him whose weapon went off and blew him up. So he's literally standing there holding his weapon and saluting the flag. And then the guy beside him, boom, and he goes down and he dies from his injuries. They would often describe him, his face. There were people who would later on would say that there were times you would come across him as you were walking across the parade ground area, and the young Union soldier would wink at you and smile and then just disappear. Now, that's interesting enough, you know, from the American Civil War period, but up through the today, they're still seeing him. In 2015, there was somebody that had visited the fort, a visitor who saw a ghostly figure of a man rising out of the shadows to salute the flag. The visitor believed that this person was Daniel Hogue. He snapped photographs, and when he got the pictures back, every one of the pictures were completely overexposed. Another person only a week before that had said she they had seen the same thing. They described it exactly the same way. The only thing that was different was that there wasn't just one soldier, there were two. And they seemed to be literally come up out of the ground. Like they were, the tourists are walking and then just in front of them, they just suddenly appeared. Then there's a story from 2014 about a woman who, her family decided to go to the fort for Mother's Day. And they're, you know, checking it all out. They got there late in the afternoon and they're trying to check it all out before closing. And they said that out of nowhere, walking in front of them, as though he didn't notice them at all, they saw a Union soldier in full uniform. And he turned around, he nodded at them, and then he looked up to where the flag was at and disappeared. So these stories, you know, they're very contemporary at this point. And I thought it was a fascinating, you know, story. There are so many cool stories about the fort. If you ever get a chance to go there, I highly recommend it. So I got you into the Civil War, and we're going to talk about some other places that are well-known battles that are, there's hauntings. So the first one I chose was Manassas. First Manassas was the first battle on land for the Civil War. This is the battle, if you ever saw anything in a movie or read in a history book about how the locals came out to watch the battle and have their picnic dinner at the beginning of the war. This is it. So the first Manassas, also known as Bull Run, depending on which side you're talking about. I think the North calls it Bull Run, the South calls it the Battle of Manassas, in Virginia. It was a horrendous battle, much more gory and a great loss of life. And nobody believed it was going to be that way. I cannot imagine, I don't understand because it's not who I am, that people packed a picnic lunch and they brought their kids and they're sitting there having tea and eating sandwiches and waiting for this great clash to happen. And then were horrified and shocked when people died in front of them.
That's like a macabre thing to do in the first place, but what did they expect? Yeah.
I know, and you know what, and it's really weird because like that's how people were. I mean, it really was. If you go to the Johnstown Flood, 1889, when the railroad got back into town, they had to rebuild the lines because they were wiped out by the flood. They had to actually bar people from going into Johnstown unless you had real business because the tourism going over there to take a picnic lunch and eat where the devastation was and they were still finding bodies was so disruptive that they had to stop it. So as macabre as it seems to us, this was a party.
Different time, I guess, but yeah.
Yeah. So yeah, it's just fascinating that people thought that way. So anyhow, this battle becomes one of a couple. There'll be a second Manassas or second Bull Run eventually. Now the stories I have read are just tourist stories. So there's one gentleman who said that when he was a kid, his family brought him there and it was a rainy day and he said we could hear the sounds of gunfire from the battle. We thought that there were like speakers in the woods and they were kind of giving you like the sound effects. Mm-hmm. He said, but we couldn't find any of them. So we asked the people, the tour guides and what have you, that were there with other groups that coming in, and they said, oh, that's absolutely no, that's not true. And he's like, but yet my mother and dad and I stood there and we heard it clearly several times, these great big, you know, the sound of a cannon, boom, room, screaming, horses, you know, neighing, the whole nine yards. And interestingly enough, as I was going down through these tales, I come across several others very similar. This one person, she shared that her boyfriend and her were walking along a pathway that leads to the bridge over Bull Run Creek. And out of nowhere, a soldier in ragged Confederate uniform comes in front of them. He smells terribly. And he turned around and he looked at her and her fiance or boyfriend, and he said, you fools, it's about to start any moment. You civilians, get off the road and get away from here. He turned to look at her boyfriend, and then he was just gone. And she said it was so creepy because from the moment we saw him, it was so cold. We were chilled. And yet, it was a hot and humid day. Now, I have to tell you, this story kind of touches my heart because there's a great story from the Gettysburg Battlefield of a reenactment where one of the reenactors, who was a friend of my dear friend Mark, Mark tells this story in one of his books, that the end of the first day, and he's up on this little hilltop, and this soldier comes up and says to him, he's all dirty, and he really looks the part, you know? Mm-hmm. And he says to him, do you have any bullets left? And he's like, I only have three. And of course, you're not allowed to have bullets on the battle. It's just a charge. It's not, it doesn't have everything, the lead and everything in them. And the guy hands him some bullets. And he says, here, son, you're going to need these by morning. And he said, I thought it was just very odd. But the guy just went down the hill. He said, and I turned to yell at him after I looked at the bullets. And I went, hey, you're not allowed to have live rounds on the battlefield, because these were live rounds in his hand, the guy had given him. And he said, as I look down the hill, there's nowhere to go. The battlefield's open, but this guy is gone. So he took them to the park rangers, and he said, I don't know who the guy was. They started looking, because obviously you do not want some crazy guy with live rounds on a battlefield during a mock battle. That might he might open fire. They never found him. However, he did send the rounds to be tested, and historians who looked at them said they were authentic and dated from the time of the Civil War.
All right, now the sciencey side of me, all right, so mm-hmm. is if you take something out of time, all right, so I mean every one of us has heard of carbon dating, okay?
Yes.
So if you take something out of time and immediately transfer it, let's say 100 years in the future, mm-hmm. it didn't age during that time. So if you were to age that thing at that time, it would show 100 years ago. Or whatever time frame, you know. So if they, I don't know how they were able to determine, but if that was true, then.
Yeah, no, I can tell you how they determined it. So they made the bullets differently. The paper and stuff would have been of a different quality, and okay. the gunpowder. So when they looked back at the bullets with the striations, the powder, the packing, all of that, it was consistent with being period correct. When you purchase the materials now, they're manufactured, they're not hand rolled like they were back then. But it's a great question.
Well, again, that's science.
Science. So one of the worst battles of the war was the battle at Chickamauga, which is in Northwest Georgia, and it was literally one of the worst battles. The casualties were insane. This is about halfway through the war, so 1863. And I have to tell you, it is a battlefield well known for its hauntings. There are ghost stories there. One of the most famous is about somebody called the Green Eyes. The legend is that there's this green-eyed apparition that roams the battlefield. And this was all that remains of a Confederate soldier. So you don't see the soldier, you just see a pair of green eyes blinking at you out of the darkness. I can't imagine. Supposedly the story is that his head was blown off by a cannon during the battle, and people need to understand, you could be vaporized by a cannon. Whenever one of those cannonballs hits you, there was nothing but red mist. So that is a very viable possibility. And that he was buried without all of his pieces, if you will, because as I said, some of them weren't there anymore. And among the pieces that were missing, of course, since it was his head that was struck, were his green eyes. And ever since the battle, people have claimed to see these green eyes, just green eyes, moving across the battlefield day and night.
Just kind of bobbing along and floating along, or yeah.
Just floating along.
Hey, all right.
Mm-hmm. It's creepy, isn't it?
A bit.
Yeah, it's creepy. And sometimes at night they will glow, but they'll still be green. Mm-hmm. This next story also, I can give you a parallel story for. It's called The Lady in White. So what people don't realize is that during the Civil War, it wasn't just men marching. Women came along. their children came along, because sometimes they didn't have anybody else to take care of them. So their husbands went that way. So the wife came along to cook and mend and what have you. She might have farmed the children out to her family, but if she couldn't, she might bring them with her. And after battles, there are many accounts of women going out to the battlefield and looking for the bodies of their dead husbands, brothers, sons. This is one of those stories. So the story is that this woman, her husband didn't come back after the battle. She was behind the lines. She waited, and she went out, and she would literally look for his corpse. She would do it at night when everybody was camping. Both sides knew what was going on. Nobody shot at these people. They would carry a lantern, and they would turn these bodies over and try to recognize something of their loved ones, which is a horrendously sad story. But they, people have observed this woman, and she, where the area is now a graveyard. And she seems to be trying to look for somebody. She goes through the motions of turning somebody over, although there's nobody you can see. And she wears a white dress. She appears all hours of the day, all hours of the night, just randomly. And it's believed that she's still looking for her dead husband, that she never found his body. And there is a story in Gettysburg, very much the same, about Wesley Culp, who was a young man from Gettysburg who ended up fighting on the Confederate side. At Culp's Hill, which is where his uncle's farm was, he ended up getting killed. The commander knew that this was his uncle's property, and he rode by and he said, I don't know what to tell you, just Wesley's dead. He's out there on the battlefield somewhere. We don't have time to look for him. So his sisters that night took lanterns, hid them under their cloaks, and went out to the battlefield and turned bodies, trying to find their brother. Found their brother, drug him back, and they buried him in the basement of their uncle's house for fear that the townspeople would be so angry at him that they would dig him up and desecrate his body.
Because he fought for the wrong side.
Yeah. Because he fought for the wrong side. And there are, to this day, there are people who claim that are there at night, that they see lights bobbing on that battlefield. And when you go out, there's nobody there.
That's a common story, though, of lights on battlefields.
Yes. You know, very much so. You all see that a lot. There's a lot of stories about the flickering lights there. But in this one particular area, they actually see the woman moving along looking. And the last story that I chose from the Chickamauga was about a lieutenant colonel by the name of Julius Gargere, who was a very well-known soldier. His fate, unfortunately, was very similar to our first soldier there. He was hit by a cannonball, and there was a stampede of horses that went by, and while he was on the ground, they trampled him the rest of the way. I don't know if he was already dead or not, but if he wasn't, they just ran off, and as they were doing it, his head hair got caught in the stirrups from one of the horses that was running and tore his head off, and it went along with them for quite a ways before it fell off the stirrup. And people have reported that they see the headless figure of a horseman galloping through the woods. And what's really interesting about this story is that he wasn't on horseback, and he didn't die at Chickamauga. He died at Murfreesboro. But yet the story continues to insist that it was Lieutenant Colonel Julius Gargere. Why? I don't know, but the story has always been about him. But it's a fascinating story, no matter how you look at it. Other people, you know, the thing you're going to hear in almost every battlefield is people smell smoke, they hear gunshots, they hear screaming, they hear phantom horses riding by them. You'll find this at almost every one of these Civil War battlefields. So, you know, I'm not going to tell you that story over and over 100 times. Now we're going to Shiloh. And it was a two-day bloodbath in 1862, April of 1862. Thousands of men were lost. They were hiding in the woods, desperately fighting to survive. It was a horrendous thing. Now this area is a beautiful park. There's a great cemetery that's gorgeous. Everything there is just so pristine. But when you stand there, you can still get that air of the fear and the pain. And a lot of them talk about hearing random gunfire. It happens on almost a daily basis, the park rangers say. They have people coming up. And you can still hear people screaming and crying. You can hear running past you as though somebody's trying to get away. There is an area there called the Bloody Pond. It's a small pond where wounded soldiers would try to crawl to after dark to get a drink of water. So when you're wounded and you're losing blood, you get extremely thirsty. And it was hot. It was April, so it was warm. And you're thirsty and you're losing blood. And that water was your only respite. So they would crawl to the water. And it was said that the water would actually turn red from the blood of the soldiers and the wounded horses that were, you know, trying to take sustenance from it. And they would, you know, fight, they would wash their wounds, they would try to, you know, clean themselves up if they thought they were, you know, trying to take care of themselves a little bit. And people died there around that pond in unprecedented numbers. Not just from the wounds, but from heat exhaustion, from those injuries. It was a bad place. To this day, this pond will turn bright red from time to time. Now, it's usually in the hottest part of the summer, and it's believed that it's due to a strange algae that's in the water, but Bloody Pond still exists. And there are stories and probably always will be stories about the pond and what really makes the pond bleed red.
Yeah, I don't think I've ever come across a pond that was pristine water either. You know, a pond indicates, you know, it's stagnant. So that's, you know, who knows what's in there. So
right. So another one of the tourist tales that you hear from the battlefield is that of a little boy. People need to understand that not only did men die in these battles, but women and children died as well. And there were little boys, as little as 9 years old, who became drummer boys and walked into battle beating a drum, some of whom do not walk back out, sadly. And one of them was a little boy by the name of Johnny Clem. He was 11. He was one of the youngest boys involved in this battle. He was one of the few that survived, in fact. So it's interesting that he would be the one that they believe haunts it. So the story goes that he made it through the battle. He actually made it through the entire war. He ended up staying in the military until 1915. When he passed away, he was buried at Arlington Cemetery. But it is said that after his death, that the people began to hear the sound of the drums beating, and they began to think that it was the soul of little Johnny Clem returning to that place where his innocence was lost, trying to call out to the soldiers who were still trapped on the battlefield. I mean, it's terrible. You'll hear stories of the cannon fire and stuff like that. Like I said, it's just a terribly sad place. One of the last places is the old Shiloh Church. Now, the original church was destroyed, and people who cared a lot about the history actually managed to get enough money together to take the original layout, blueprint layout, and build the church exactly the way it had been, on exactly the spot where it had originally been. It's interesting because this church is a tourist attraction now, as you can well imagine. It's very rustic looking, very beautiful. And people go in, tourists go in, and they take pictures. And that they often will see little white blurry images in the photographs, and they don't know who they are, but there's nobody else there, so they don't know who this mass is that's in their photographs. And this has happened repeatedly. Some of them tell other stories that are equally as, you know, tragic and terrible. There's the story of the unknown footsteps. There's people who go through this certain area, they go down this little wooded area, and you walk through the little lane that's there, and all of a sudden you'll hear footsteps pounding on the ground, and you turn around fully expecting to see somebody running towards you, and there's nobody there. The footsteps run past and keep on going down further into the woods, as if making their way across the battlefield. And multiple people have had this experience, and none of them have an explanation for it other than a phantom soldier trying to get away. There's a place there also called the Peach Orchard. Obviously in Gettysburg, there's also a place called the Peach Orchard. And there's sightings of a man whose face is just a blur. There's no features. And he is seen moving across the battlefield, and then after a couple minutes he'll just wink out. There were so many people that died there, there's no way of knowing who it was, but he's been reported by many tourists through the years. You know, even the ranger housing on that battlefield area is considered very haunted. And there's this really interesting story about a place called the Primitive Cabin. So there's this little cabin that sits on there. It's also part of the tourist thing. You can go through it and what have you. Multiple people have said that they were, they entered the cabin, and usually up in the loft, they see a small barefoot boy dressed in gray pants and a white shirt. And he's kind of rough looking, you know, like the, he's dirty and the clothes are kind of rumply. And as soon as he sees them, he looks over the side, sees them. He comes climbing down the ladder from the loft, past them and outside. There's multiple stories of this happening, or vice versa. The boy opens the door and the tourist is already there. He catches their eye, realizes they see him, and he turns around and runs away. And people have followed him, thinking that he must be a lost child, stuff like that, and they can never find him. There's this really interesting story from one of the tourists, where when she was a little girl, about 12 or 13 years old, her family took her to the battlefield, and they came to the Primitive Cabin. They came in, her and her siblings and her mom and her dad, and that little boy peeked over the side, saw them, scurried down the ladder past them and out the door. And as the mother said, "I wonder if that little boy is lost." So they turned around to follow him. They followed him all the way down the path, which leads to a parking lot today. And as they get to the parking lot, he's suddenly gone. And the mom's standing there kind of looking around, and she's like, "Where did he go? Did he get in somebody's car?" And the dad just looked at her and he said, "No, honey, he didn't go anywhere near the cars. I don't think that little boy knew what the cars were." Interestingly enough, this woman marries a guy 20 some years later, and she's telling him this story one night when he turns pale, and he's like, "You're kidding me. You saw that?" And she's like, "Yeah." He's like, "I was in my early 20s when a bunch of my friends and I went there, and they had a very similar experience. Described the boy to the T, the color of his hair, the color of his eyes, you know, everything about him. And they followed him outside, again thinking he must be lost, or at the very least he's part of the attraction and there's a story to be told outside. Mm-hmm. And he wasn't there, even though they literally were two steps behind.
That's and a common theme through some of your stories. You know, people are two steps behind and yet there's nothing there. Yeah.
I've had that experience. Have you ever done that and it, like, been in a haunted place and you're like, you see something and you literally like two, three steps away, you open the door, they just went through and there's nothing there?
I cannot say I have, no.
I spend a lot of time in haunted houses, so I can tell you I've had that experience a couple times. It's very disconcerting when, you know you just saw something and it should be on the other side of that door, and there's this great big open area. There's nowhere for it to have gone, and yet it's not there. It's fascinating when that happens, because for me, I'm start with the, okay, what did I see? Where did it go? But, you know, my brain's going through all those questions. So there's, before we leave the area completely, one of the people that was participated, if you will, in everything that had happened at Shiloh was a nurse. Her name was Nurse Amy, and she supposedly haunts the Beauregard Keys house in the French Quarter of New Orleans, which was the home of one of the officers who had fought at Shiloh. He was a leading general, and his name was Tordant Beauregard. His Pierre Gustave Tordant Beauregard. Sorry, that mouthful. Mm-hmm. It would not fit in the boxes. And after the battle, he ended up accepting defeat. He would return to New Orleans and spend the rest of his days. And then this young woman, Amy, had been a nurse there, and supposedly she's seen caring for him as an elderly man, that she continued nursing rather than getting married and ended up coming and taking care of him. She had been on the battlefield as well, and it was as though that bond kept them together. And so she haunts his home, and all, and like I said, the whole thing started because they both had survived that battle. I wanted to tell the Rich Mountain ghost stories. I'm not sure if you have ever heard of it.
Have not. No.
There are so many. Literally, I had to pick. So, in 1867, the war is over. There's a guy by the name of Kittle, and his companions are mining up on Rich Mountain. They're mining coal, which was actually the area is part of the Rich Mountain battleground. So he and his cousin Daniel are boarding at the house of a gentleman by the name of Mr. Hart that lives very near the battlefield, because they go out there and there's this mine on that area and they work it every day and they walk back in. Now the house where Mr. Hart lives had been used as a field hospital. Every place that was available, from pigsties and chicken coops to mansions, were turned into field hospitals. When you have that many wounded, and many of these battles had thousands wounded. As I said, the Battle of Gettysburg alone, 51,000 injured and dead. Then everything is pressed into service. Mr. Hart's house was pressed into service. And the two cousins were sharing a bedroom there. They slept in a single bed, or you know, a single double bed together. And on their very first night there, they started to hear this sound. They described it as like the wind ripping through the room, but they saw nothing. And after a couple of nights of hearing it, they finally approached Mr. Hart and said, "There's something wrong with that bedroom." And he said, "Don't worry about it. It's just the ghost of one of them soldier boys who died here." And so this went on for a little while. And then one night, Kittle was sleeping by himself, and he woke up because he felt cold and clammy. And he looked over and he saw what he described as 8 shadowy figures clad in Confederate uniform standing nearby. 4 were walked toward the bed where he was laying, and they removed the covers from off of him. They stepped over and lifted up what was an invisible object and laid it on the blanket. And then the other 4 picked up the ends of the blanket and walked out of the room with this load that he couldn't see. He could see the blanket sagging, and he said it dawned on him immediately these were the pallbearers. As they passed out of the door, he said, suddenly they passed, I could see the figure laying in the blanket suddenly. And he said he was a good-looking, handsome young man. When they reached the hallway, he said, "I heard something like wood striking the wooden floor, and I heard a door closing." And the blankets were laying on the floor outside his bedroom door. So he got up, looked out there, realized they were gone, gathered up his blankets. And this went on over and over and over. It went on so many times that he and his cousin decided to move out because they couldn't handle it anymore. It's you know, it's one thing to hear a little noise. It's a different thing to have dead people snatch the blanket off of you and carry a corpse out of your bedroom at night. And, you know, this is the ghost of the Rich Mountain battlefield. One of many such stories. It's truly hard for us to wrap our heads around what really happened in the American Civil War. And just to give you a little idea, during the Civil War from 1861 to 1865, 620,000 of the 2.4 million soldiers from both sides that fought died, and many more were injured. Much of the South was left in ruin, And it was a horrendous time and a horrendous death toll. It's so hard for us to wrap our minds around that today. 620,000.
Yeah, most of the towns that I've lived in, I mean, even the one I live in now, about 8,000 people.
Yeah.
I don't like to live in large areas. I like small town living. And that's, you know, just, and I'm thinking, like, if we took everybody from the town and, you know, went into like a football stadium or something like that, you know, that would be a large group of people. Now, multiply that by 800.
Yeah. When you look at the pictures from the Battle of Gettysburg, which are the ones that I'm most familiar with, and you see just you scattered bodies as far as you can see, and horses, and the injured, and it's again 51,000 people, you know. It's hard to wrap your head around it. They're stacked like cordwood in some places. It's insane. And they didn't, and I have to tell you, there are stories, many such stories, because if they thought you were dead, you got thrown in amongst the corpses. There's a story from the Daniel Lady Farm. They turned the barn into, because it was cool and dark, so they had to store the body somewhere. And they turned it into a place to put the corpses. And there is a story of a man who was thrown in there, and he kept screaming for help, but nobody could help him. They would have had to have moved too many bodies.
That would be a terrible way to die.
It would. So I hope everybody enjoyed the stories, but I also hope that I gave you a view of what a civil war really looks like.
And let's not have another.
Amen. And let's pray for peace for other folks all around the world. Our hearts ache for the loss of life, no matter where. I don't understand why we can never have peace as humans.
Because we're humans.
It's a tragic thing. But I just wanted to, I had just promised that gentleman I would tell him stories that were not Gettysburg stories, exactly. And while doing it, it's every time I go into these battlefield stories, I'm just overcome with the amount of death. That's entire counties. There's, you know, cities. That's cities worth of people. And every one of them, sons, fathers, brothers, loved ones of someone. And that, in fact, that's what started the spiritualist movement, is so many people didn't know what happened to their loved ones that they began seeking out, you know, ways to talk to the dead to see if they could find out where their sons were buried or their husbands, and if there was closure for them. What a terrible mystery to have to live with.
Agreed.
So with that, I will say good evening.
Good night, Patty.